Hello, everybody, and welcome. You're listening to SFF Addicts. Today's episode of the podcast is an author panel from TBRCon 2022, a virtual literature convention run by FanFi Addicts David Walters, with a focus on science fiction, fantasy, and horror. What you're about to listen to is just one of the panels from the convention that I'll be publishing here on the SFF Addicts podcast feed. Mind you, I won't be uploading all of the panels as there are a lot, 24 in total. So if you're aching for more, head over to the FanFi Addict YouTube channel to see full video of each and every one. And if you can't catch a panel live, don't worry. They will be available there from now until YouTube's demise. Also, TBRCon is available to stream live every day until January 30th, 2022 on the FanFi Addict Twitter account, Facebook page, or YouTube channel. So for more information on the convention, including the full schedule of panels and more, head over to fanfiaddict.com/TBRCon-2022. I'll also include all links in the show notes for your convenience. All right, now on to the panel. Here we go.
Hello, everyone. It looks like we're live. Thank you very much for coming and attending Fantasy Around the World. We're going to have an hour and a half's worth of hopefully scintillating and absolutely captivating discussions and talks today. And we have an incredible group of panelists who I am about to let introduce themselves. If we could maybe start with Fonda Lee right there, who's first on my screen. The quick introduction.
Hey, everyone. I'm Fonda Lee. I am the author of the epic fantasy trilogy, The Greenbone Saga, which starts with Jade City and continues with Jade War and just concluded with Jade Legacy, which came out late last year. So it is now complete. For those of you who like to binge, now is the time. I am also the author of a number of science fiction novels and some smattering of short fiction out there. So that is me. Glad to be here.
All right, and next to my screen, I see K.S. Villoso.
Hi, I'm K.S. Villoso. I'm the author of Chronicles of the Bitch / Wolf Queen, and which starts with The Wolf of Oren Yarrow, which came out in 2020. And the sequel is The Ikisar Falcon, followed by The Dragon of Jinsayang, which came out last year.
Okay, and next I see C.L. Clark.
Hi, everyone. I'm C.L. Clark, or Sheree, and I'm the author of The Unbroken and several short stories, as well as the former editor of the podcast fantasy magazine Podcastle, and the former editor as well of the nonfiction Sifwa blog.
And last but never least...
Okay. My name is Ogene Chowe Dona Odekpeki. I'm the author of Ife Yuku, The Tale of Imade Yunuagbon, and a number of other short stories and novelettes. I edited the Dominion Anthology, the first ever year's best African speculative fiction anthology, and the Africa Risen Anthology, forthcoming on tor.com later this year.
Thank you, everyone. And thank you so much for all of you for being here to do this discussion. And I'm going to admit that I was perhaps a little selfish, and I think I admire all of you so incredibly much. And so I've developed and asked, I'm going to ask a bunch of questions that are really interesting to me. So hopefully they're incredibly interesting to the audience as well. But these are things I would love to hear from all of you and to learn from you today. So, I mean, to start us off on hard mode, and if you believe the following to be true, when do you remember realizing or understanding that language had power? And what do you think that power is? Fonda.
Jeez, Evan. Throw me a softball. you know, I think it was, I can't pinpoint a particular time. I feel like it was very just organically osmosed into my consciousness from a young age, probably because I was a very voracious reader as a child. I actually remember being in, I think, like kindergarten or first grade, and we had sticker charts for the number of books that you read, and you would get like a sticker if you read a book. And I just took that as a personal challenge to like rack up as many stickers as I could. So I was always just very voracious as a reader, and also of just a really imaginative kid, the sort of kid that had like make-believe friends and would make up stories. And I think the power of language struck me as something that was integrally tied with the power of imagination. Because you can open this book and look at printed words on a page and be transported to someplace completely different and out of your own experience. And that I think was a very natural leap for me from realizing that these words can transport me out of my life and my daily concerns to, oh, hey, if I put these words on the page, I have a power. I have a power that like is something that I realized pretty early on I was better at than a lot of other kids. And so from there, it just became, reading and writing became kind of part of my makeup.
Thank you very much. And okay, you next.
So I think with me, it was kind of baked into our culture because as some of you know, the Philippines was a colonized country, and like one of the heroes that they taught us when we were young was Jose Rizal, who was a writer. And the thing about him was that he was killed. He was executed by the Spanish just because of a book he wrote, or a couple of books. And, you know, I think from an early age, I understood that something as simple as a story could threaten a big organization to the point where they have to silence this guy who wasn't even like, it wasn't like he was going around, you know, trying to instigate a revolution, although they pinned it on him. Like when they killed him, a revolution did spring up from the fact that they killed him. So, you know, early on, I knew that, you know, language stories have power. Like it's just something that I kind of grew up with. Yeah. So, you know, I started writing stories pretty young, and, you know, you can kind of see like you can get people to pay attention when you write something. And I think it just kind of formed in my head that, you know, when you're careful with how you write something and you're careful with your message, it just, you know, it forms a kind of magic in a way.
Perfect, thank you. And Sheree, if you would give us your thoughts.
Yeah, I think even though I did from an early age pick up language and stories as a mode of escape and something that did make me feel stronger and more confident, I think the more accurate answer actually comes from a different angle. I learned that language has power probably when I got told off for like not saying things the right way, or like not in terms of accent or something, but like, oh, that's not how little girls talk, or oh, that's not the kind of language you should be using to adults and stuff like that. And I was like, oh, well, I can say whatever I want as long as I say it in this kind of tone or with these kinds of words. And then of course I had siblings, which was another kind of like language strength, because they'd be like, oh, well, Sheree did this. And I'd be like, no, I didn't do that. So there becomes that sort of like lies are power, and who tells what story first is power. And obviously we can take that a lot farther, but that's where it started, I think, is for me to recognize these things that people say have impact on other people's lives, however true they are. So,
thank you. And Ogunechovwe, if you could give us your thoughts.
Okay. Well, for me, it comes from two places. One of them is actually very simplistic, and the other one not so much. The first of them is movies, shows, and books. Naturally, I started out consuming stories before I started trying to create mine. And one of the major kind of stories I consumed was fantasy classic fantasy epics, you know, Lord of the Rings, you know, that kind of stuff. You know, there were usually big battles and, you know, wars and warriors, you know, classic, you know, that kind of thing. And there's something I realized before every big battle, there's usually a speech. You know, there's that moment where the general or the, you know, the person leading the army stands in front or walks his horse past the front lines and, you know, he gives this grand speech and everybody's shouting and yelling and, you know, there, you know, so that's one of the, you know, very simple things that made me realize the power of language every time. You see, there's this crowd of people that have left their home with one purpose alone, to engage in war, you know. But at the end of the day, what motivates them, what gives them that final drive? It's not their country. It's not patriotism. It's not, it's simple words that gives them that final, you know, urge to rush into battle, to die or kill, you know. So it just every time I saw that scene, it impressed on me how powerful language is. You know, it's something that can make people literally live or die, you know, and it doesn't even have to be something as complex as a story with a whole complete arc and characters. It can be something as simple as speech, you know, a 5-minute speech or a couple of words. So that's the first of them. The second is, growing up, I was hearing impaired, you know, seriously hearing impaired. So a lot of the time, and I was also very shy, so I wasn't bold enough to say, could you repeat what you just said, even though I didn't hear it. And I tried to sort of figure out what was going on, you know, from people's body language, you know. So I ended up coming across as slow, as being dumb, because I was never quite following. But you see, it was the simple fact that I was caught out of the loop of the language that was being spoken. So it wasn't exactly that I was dumb. It's just, it was a case of language, you know, and it also impressed on me how powerful language is. It can alter how we view people. You know, as far as everybody was concerned, I was dumb, but it was just a case of we weren't speaking the same language. So, yeah, those scenarios.
Yeah, thank you for that. Thank you for sharing. I appreciate it. And, wow, those were fantastic answers. And, I'm glad I'm asking such tough questions, because I'm going to be putting all of this into my work in the future. I can already see. So next up is, I'd love to know, for the panel, in all of your personal opinions, what do you feel is the most important thing that a truly great fantasy story can do? What's the most important thing that a truly great fantasy story can do, in your opinion? And Kenny?
Because there's no one answer to this in my in my opinion. It's, you know, fantasy, epic fantasy, for one thing, can really inspire as like, you know, as a kid watching the movies, the Lord of the Rings movies, right? They had a message that was like, oh, you know, someone small can make a big difference. And the great thing about fantasy is it you can just make it explode. Like, you could make it as small a story as possible and just keep adding it and like make it larger than life, larger than, you know, than time. And you know, you can refine the settings around a message. Like, the world building can hone down on a single message and then just make that message just fly. And you know, so fantasy has so much power in that there's like, you can do practically anything with it. You know, no matter what people say, or there's like, oh, there's rules in fantasy. I think the best thing about it is just there are no actual rules, right? And it's the one genre where you could really take your imagination for a spin, and then, you know, but not leave it so that there's ambiguity. Like, you could just really make your message shine using the world and the settings and the characters. So, yeah. So, it's, like, the one thing is that it could be everything.
Nice, thank you. And, Sheree, any thoughts on that?
I mean, like Kay said, I think the beauty of it is that the answer is infinite. It could literally make anybody want to do anything, depending on the story. But one thing that I really value in it for myself and also for the work that I personally put into the world is, you know, I want to inspire people to make more art, more stories. And sometimes that's going to be because they really hated my story. And they're like, you know what, I need to write against this. And I'm like, yeah, let's do it. Come on. Because I think that the great thing about stories is that dialogue that comes. I mean, my story, The Unbroken, is writing against actually a novel that I really, really loved. I liked Django Wexler's The Thousand Names, but I wanted to tell the story differently. I wanted to write from the other point of view. And so, boom, that there's The Unbroken. It's about, instead of being about one country as the hero going in to take somebody's magic and find these magic tablets, it's about the country that they're taking the magic from instead. And maybe I'm going to write something one day, I hope I am, that somebody's like, no, that's not how this really goes. And really just dig into or expose more and more of humanity. And that's really what I'm in this genre for. It's what I'm in this business for. And also, I mean, you know, I'm here for the fan fiction and the fan art as well. Like, all of the extra art that comes out of creation is like, I don't know, that's the riches of this entire endeavor, I think.
Awesome. Excellent. Thank you. And I'm going to talk away your thoughts on this as well.
Okay. Well, for me, the best part of fantasy is the magic, you know. I mean, and I don't mean just the, you know, the flashy, the wonders. I kind of mean, you know, magic sort of, it's a part of us, you know, how we imagine it. It says a lot about who we are. You know, fantasy is usually involves magic or the spiritual on some level. And I think that us writing fantasy is a reflection of how we see the spiritual. You know, everybody comes to the spiritual on some level. We all have some perception of it, you know, some understanding of it, even if we're atheists or agnostics, whatever our religious leaning is. So I think that writing fantasy sort of forces us to show, you know, how we perceive the spiritual, you know, and it reflects a lot on our culture, you know, our beliefs, our views, you know, all these things that have shaped us even subconsciously, and it all reflects in our magic, no matter how contrived or made up. So what fantasy does is it shows us that bit of, you know, magic or, you know, what we take away from or how we come to spirituality.
Oh, thank you. And Fonda, if you could tell us your thoughts.
Well, if you think about fantasy as a genre, it is the height of deceit, right? Like, all of us fiction authors are lying, right? We're making up stuff and we're feeding it to people and say, hey, believe in this for, you know, the number of hours that you were with me. Reading this book, suspend disbelief and believe what I'm telling you. And there is a spectrum of how much different fiction writers are lying, right? You could be a historical fiction author who's trying to relay something with as much historical accuracy as possible, but you're lying about certain elements of the story or changing the characters. You could be writing a contemporary fiction novel that, you know, the setting is real, but the people are different. And fantasy is like the ultimate deceit, right? We're telling you to, we're lying about the world. We're lying about the way the world works. We're lying about the characters. We're lying about everything. And I think the greatest thing that a fantasy story can do is, through lying, tell the truth. By wrapping the everything in the lie, the world, the characters, the laws of nature. I mean, we're not even science fiction writers who at least might make, you know, some concession to following rules of science. I mean, we're basically saying, hey, we'll don't believe anything that we say. Everything is different. And yet through doing that, we can tell the truth about human nature, about power, about the nature of our own history and our identity and relationships between people and culture. And there's so many things that we can tell the truth about by lying.
Wow. Excellent. Thank you. Thank you, everyone, for those answers. Loving this. And okay, so next, I guess I'm going to dig into a little bit more about why we tell these lies. So to the entire panel, what do you need from writing? What did you need from writing when you started out? And what do you think you need from it now? And Okina Chopra, if you could start us off. Oh, yeah, you're still
muted.
Oh, yeah, sorry. Well, writing was a lot of things for me growing up. I mentioned hearing impaired. It generally a lot of disabilities. So I was sort of looking for, it might sound very cliche, but an escape, you know. It was a world where I could immerse myself and interact fully. You know, I could speak the language of the characters and, you know, more than I could connect with, people in the outside, people around, you know. It also was it was a source of wonder, you know. Magic is fascinating, it's interesting, it creates more possibilities, you know. So it was all those things for me. Sorry, can you say the question again? I can pinpoint on it more thoroughly.
No, you were nailing it. But yeah, what did you need from writing when you started out? And what do you think you need from it now?
Yeah, I needed a place to go to escape to. And, as time passed, I think that it kind of changed for me. It's more different now because I'm not trying to hide anymore. It's sort of like three stages. I needed a place to hide. Then I needed a place to grow, to become myself, to understand myself more, you know, my view of things, the kind of person that I was or wanted to be based off of how I paired myself off with characters, you know, their motivations, their actions, you know, they were sort of role models, you know, role models, villains, warnings, you know. Then it's finally something that I need to project myself, you know, to project my voice, you know, and I mean, not exactly I've been an orator, but I can reach people, you know, I can project my views, you know, my ideas, my ideals through fiction, you know. I can, it sort of became the opposite of what it started as. You know, instead of a place to hide, it's a place to project myself, you know. I can create characters that are like me, that are like broken or, you know, impaired or, you know. So, yeah, that's, writing for me.
That's a powerful story and an amazing sort of character arc of your own in terms of writing and how it started for you and where it went. Right. And Sheree, any thoughts on that as well, on the question?
I think, like Ogun Chove said, it was a place where I could grow a lot. And even escape. When I think about why I started, I think so much of it was because it was a place where I could deal with gender expectations in a way that I wanted to. So I was a very athletic kid, but in a family where a lot of the women were like, no, we need you to go sit down in your little dress. And I was like, oh God, I hate dresses. and that was That's a fairly common thing, I think, when boys get to go outside and play in a family and girls have to sit down and look pretty. And so I was really drawn to fantasy worlds where either I could pretend to be the boy who had the adventures, or as grew up fairly common in the 90s, there were lots of books where girls literally dressed as boys to either go sail on a pirate ship or go to boys' night school. With convenient twins or something like that to like body swap with or anything like that. And so that was what drew me as a reader. And as a young writer, I was often doing that body swapping myself and writing boy characters that I could be. And while I think, you know, you can write different gender characters just because, I don't think that's what I was doing. I think I was really trying to figure out how I could be whatever I was in a space that it was safe to. And then I ended up coming out later, which is an entirely different but related story. And now the other half of that story is just, instead of experimenting or trying on different clothes, I just get to do the things that I always wanted to do, things that are fun. But fully embodied and fully cognizant of what I'm doing and why I like these things. So like, if I want to have queer characters in my books or even like writing male characters, like I get to do that kind of thing. I don't know, just more aware of the potential I have in writing for myself, from myself, instead of stumbling into it accidentally. But also I know that I am also writing for other kids like me who will find my work at some point and have some sort of touchstone, just like I had with the Alana books were one of my big ones, or Jackie Faber. Was the girl on the pirate ship or whaler ship or something like that. And so for another kid to find my book and think, oh, well, here's a girl with a sword. I can be just like her. I don't have to sit somewhere and look pretty. I can chop things and look pretty, or chop things and look ugly, or like literally anything. And that's kind of what I write for now. And just because I want to chop things still. So
love that. Thank you. And Fonda.
No, Evan, I feel like my career, like if my journey as a writer has kind of come around full circle in some ways. And I think back to when I first started writing, it was really for me. It was because I wanted to play. I had fictional characters and a magic world, and I wanted to play in it, and that was just, it was just fun. It was something that you know, I did as a hobby, that, and I remember, like, I wrote a novel in biology class in high school because I didn't want to do biology, so I would write this story on a graphing calculator, and I just cast all my classmates as characters in it, and that was just what I did for fun. And then there was, you know, a period where I didn't really write that much because I had a day job and family and life got in the way. And I came back to writing with a vengeance. And for a while, writing was about getting published. And I think many of us go through the cycle where, you know, you turn what you love into a career and an ambition, and you leave behind other opportunities. I left my day job and said, hey, this is, I want to do what I love. And there's this period where I felt very driven to get published as part of it was ego for sure, but also this sense of wanting to prove that this thing that I had done had worth and that other people might want to read it. And that there was some validation to other people reading what I wrote and enjoying it, and publishing industry and all that. And then after, you know, 6 books now, I feel like I've come back around to be like, hey, I'm doing this for, I want to make this about being fun in the long run, right? How do I have a sustainable career? Not just, you know, one book, not just finish this book, but how do I keep writing and having this be fun and have the joy that I had when I was writing for only myself continue now that I'm a professional at it? And also with that kind of added layer of I want to make sure I'm continuing to write for myself and have it be fun, but also to reach the readers who are going to like what I write. And, you know, I'm writing for me, but I'm also writing for, I guess, all the other sort of mirror me's when it comes to taste in the stories that I want to put out. So I think that, you know, many of us probably go through that, those sort of ebbs and flows of like, wow, like we're doing this for ourselves and it's fun. And now it's stressful because you're under contract and you have deadlines and you have reviews and people are talking about your book on Goodreads too. Okay, now how do I internalize that I still am doing this for myself first and foremost, even though hopefully I'm being paid for it.
Yeah, I'm taking mad mental notes, having completed 6 books. Congratulations. I'm working on number 3, so I'm taking mad mental notes on a nice, awesome career director day. Thank you.
There is life after the 3rd book, Evan.
Please, I hope so. Oh, my goodness. And Kay, your thoughts?
Yeah, like everyone else was saying, when they started out, it was play. It was your playground where you could like do anything you want with the characters, which, you know, spoiler alert for me, it usually involves killing them or hurting them in some way. But like the biggest thing for me was like exploration, because, you know, when you're like where I grew up, there, like, I didn't really go out much, you know, and books were expensive. So it was like, it was my own entertainment / you know, escape in a way, where you get to see things that you wouldn't normally see in your everyday. And then the funny part is later on, because like I loved fantasy so much and I loved writing like in like scenes in the wilderness and camping, that we started doing that. Like we moved to Canada, and then when we were able, when we finally had a car, I started doing a lot of backpacking trips in the mountains, and, you know, it was great. So like my fantasy started to evolve in a way where, you know, now that you have it all out of the way, you know, you've explored everything, it started moving inward, where I started writing things that were very introspective. And I think in the last few books that I've done, I started, you know, kind of adjusting like the way I describe things, where, you know, the environment started reflecting what was inside the character. I think there was one, I think it was book 2. This is not really a spoiler, but, you know, she goes into a room, like the main character goes into a room and she sees just how empty it is. Like the bed is like, is bare, and, you know, everything feels cold. And I just use that to kind of contrast or kind of reflect on her marriage. And it like I started, the way I started writing is that, you know, since I've done so many books and I feel like I've explored a lot of things, it just started really digging deeper, where I think in a way it's like I'm exploring inside now. Like I'm looking for questions, not so much answers, but, you know, questions over, say, like a particular character, because I write very character driven stories. So I really, really dig deep into a character now. It's just, you know, I it's not enough to have a character that just goes through all of these adventures, but, you know, there's a certain, I guess, personality flaw or a certain problem this character has, where the exploration is now revealing deeper. So it's almost like the outside plot and the inside, like the inside character arc kind of meets. And then I do a lot of making the environment reflect that. So in a way, I'm still playing. It's just, it doesn't look like my play from the beginning. It's just, I'm going nuts now.
No, that's fantastic. I think a lot of the books that I love the most are the books that do feel like they're doing a lot of that, where what's happening inside of all the characters is reflected in the world, and sort of the themes are wrapped in everything, which again, is, I think we were talking about earlier, that's one of the things that fantasy gets to do especially well, because we get to create things whole cloth. So yeah, very nice. Some of my favorite stuff now, moving on to a little bit of businessy type things, but also in the way that we write. Practically speaking, the business side of publishing often plays at least some part in the work. But if it didn't, and if your next book or series would sell 2 million copies, no matter what, as long as you tried your damnedest to deliver something that you'd be proud of, what do you think, if anything, would change about the type of story you'd tell or the way you'd tell it? Sheree.
Nothing. So I kind of, I mean, like we just talked about, I'm still very much writing for fun. I mean, I'm not going to say there's not stress, like, cause I'm writing my first contracted books, like for the first time, and oh God, that's awful. It's a whole nother, but I am still managing to hold on to the fact that I like these characters. I want to make some of them kiss. I want to make some of them kill, and sometimes at the same ones. And that's just really fun to me. And so, to be honest, I think I probably wouldn't change anything. I mean, there might be another, like a bonus, a little bonus boot scene that doesn't actually cut out when the boots come off and the boots go back on. I'm just gonna write what I want to write. And unless my editor says, this is just terribly inappropriate, Sheree, you just need to stop. I don't think she will. I'm feeling pretty good.
Okay, awesome. Good stuff. Looking at Chopway, what about you?
Okay, I'm kind of used to doing things my own way. So, yeah, I'm probably going to do exactly what I'm going to do, no matter what the wise thing is, or, you know, what the profitable thing or what the lucrative thing is. All the books I have currently are self-published. The Dominion Anthology, which contained my novella, my award-winning novella, the Year's Best Anthology, Bridging Worlds Anthology, they're basically all they're all self-published, you know. So I don't think I would do anything differently, you know, because I'm doing it my way, and I'm getting as much as I can get out of this. My novella, Ifeyuku, Tale of Imade Yunuagbo, it may not have sold 1 million copies and put me on the New York Times bestselling list, but it did exactly what I expected it to do without, you know, much of anything. It's a novella inside an anthology, so it didn't have its own cover or its own reviews or, you know, its own hype, but, you know, it managed to do everything I wanted without having to do all those things. So, you know, I don't think that I would necessarily have to go out of my way to tell the kind of stories that I don't feel like I should be telling, you know. So, yeah, that's pretty much it for me.
Excellent. And given that a lot of the work is multi-award nominated and multi-award winning, I mean, you know, maybe it's all good.
Yeah, exactly.
And Fonda, thoughts on this?
I'm going to sound repetitive, but I also can't really think of what I would do differently, because there's, for me, the satisfaction of finishing the series or the novel is tied to, but still independent from, its commercial success. Like, I even if you said, hey, like, this is going to sell you know, way better if you change genres or, I don't know, completely change the main character or write this thing that doesn't feel good to you. I probably wouldn't do it because, you know, at the end of the day, there's a lot of easier ways to make money than writing. So, yeah, I feel like if you told me the next book was going to be a runaway bestseller, I could step back and definitely not do as many blog posts or panels or social media. That's definitely, that all would get cut out. But other than that, like the actual work itself, I don't think would be impacted that much.
Good stuff. And Kay, your thoughts?
So I think I understand your question in a way where you're saying, because tropes sell really well, right? And, you know, there's certain beats that if you hit, books like will just take off. And I self-publish some of my stuff, so I can I can see it, right? Like there's a book that has, you know, farm boy tropes, and it's just so much easier to sell that than the book where, you know, I just kind of did whatever. Unfortunately, I always kind of do whatever. So nothing much will change. This is why I don't sell a lot. But I just think it's for me, it's really, really hard to write something where I don't feel like writing it, where I'm just supposed to hit these tropes. I like taking tropes and then tearing them apart. So, you know, like I wouldn't do anything different. That's just the way it is. But yeah, like, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I think for me, it sounds really interesting to hear everyone's answers because before becoming sort of a writer, really, I had the impression that, you know, publishers really pushed and influenced what writers write. But at least with everyone here, people seem to be saying, nah, I this is so much a part of me that I have to tell the story that I want to tell. And we don't, it seems like we don't tend to feel that our publishers are pushing us in any one direction or making us include or exclude things. Is that fair to say?
Mm-hmm. I actually, in the process of thinking about a next project, like after the entire Magic of the Lost trilogy, I was talking to my editor and told her this new idea. And she just typed back, that is the most C.L. Clark TM thing I have ever heard. Can't wait to see the entire book. And I was like, all right, here we go. So hopefully you guys will see that one day, but we're not there yet. Just pie in the sky. I have two more books to write.
Yeah, but that's awesome. And I think that's a misconception that I definitely had about the industry before coming into it. And again, my experience is so limited. Maybe there are places or pockets where there's a lot more editorial influence over the work, but it's amazing and so gratifying to hear that everyone here does not seem to feel that like that's a thing that's happening to them. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Please, Fonda.
I just wanted to say, I think I agree with you, Evan, that I have not felt editorial pressure to, you know, go in a certain direction with my career, to write a certain thing. The consideration comes more from a readership point of view. And it's not that my editor is saying, hey, like, you should do this. It's more that I am considering, okay, well, I have a bunch of readers who like what I've written so far. And to what extent do I want to deliver something in my next project that will appeal to those readers and keep them on board. And I think that's something that is a conversation that you have with yourself and that you do have with your agent and you have with your editor. But I don't feel like that is that's an external pressure. I think that's more of a, you know, what do you want out of your career and what trajectory do you want to have? And to what extent do you want to have a brand and how wide or narrow do you want your brand to be? And I think those are all extremely valid questions to be asking yourself, and there's no right answer.
Yeah, no, thank you. And I appreciate that. And I love that type of thinking as well about looking at this from that business perspective, even though there is the very large art component and creative component to what we do. And quickly, if I could direct this question to Chowboy, publishing is sort of a lot of indie work right now. You know, you're not going to have that editorial pressure, but then what pressures do you feel that you face in the type of work that you're doing?
Well, there's I don't know. I could say we sort of eliminated the middleman, but the trick is that you know, when you don't eliminate the middleman, you become the middle person, you know. So it's kind of like you always have a boss, you know. If your boss isn't the editor, if you're the editor, your boss is the audience, you know. So, you know, in as much as you do what you want, there's still the final concern of how your work is received, you know. And the audience can be a harsh master, you know, at times, you know. We read a lot of reviews and you know, some of them, a lot of them, they have very common or similar complaints. You know, they're talking about the language, the dialogue, you know, because we're writing from cultures and perspectives that people are not familiar with. You know, sometimes your work is too dystopian, it's too gritty and gory, and you know, it's you know, supposedly to an inappropriate level sometimes. So you're asking yourself, too gory, too dystopian for who? You know, so, you know, there's all these issues, you know, with publishing and editing yourself, because you do want to be read at the end of the day. You know, you're an artist, you know, whether you see yourself as an artist or a business person, you either want to be appreciated or, you know, patronized, so, and that requires interaction with the final element. So those are some of the concerns that come up.
Exactly. Thank you. Yeah. And you know what? This discussion is leading right into the next question, which is maybe almost too similar, but we'll see how it goes, because I'm actually interested to keep this part of the talk going. I'm just about to finish season 2 of The Witcher. Like, I'm on the penultimate episode, and it's in-world characters in the show. They make a few in-world comments on real-world reactions to things from the show's first season. For example, they talk about, like, in-world characters will talk about the show's challenging dual timelines from season 1, some of the costuming choices, and even the virality of the song's in-world songs, one of the song's in-world songs. So in today's continually connected world, reactions to our work, they're everywhere. So I'm curious, how have you found that reactions to your work affect your work? And if so, how? And if not, how do you keep those reactions at bay? And Fonda's just finished a trilogy, an incredible trilogy. So I'm going to start with Fonda.
This is such a hard thing to navigate. I think we've all been there, where, you know, gone are the days where you send off the manuscript and, you know, you can be a hermit and not get the reader reactions, like, instantaneously. And, you know, the people feel very free to access authors now, right? Like, they'll reach a chapter and they will immediately tweet at you. I think every author kind of has to find their own happy place in terms of how much to interact with that feedback mechanism. And again, I'm not sure that there is a right answer, because there are some authors, I think, who, especially indie pubbed authors, who are able to write and release on a very fast schedule, who do take those reader comments into consideration when they're you know, working on the next installment. But there's also something to be said for, you know, how much it messes you up. And it really can mess you up, because good or bad, it's an external distraction. If your work is received, if you get criticisms over some element, you start to second guess yourself. If you get glowing reviews, you also start to second guess yourself, because you start wondering, oh gosh, everyone loved the first book. There's no way that I'm changing things in the second book. Are they going to be mad at me? Are they going to, like, all of a sudden not like it anymore? So there are a lot of, it will cause you to question, you know, your initial artistic vision. And I think that can sometimes be helpful. If you're seeing consistent feedback about something, like if everyone is saying something about your work that you feel is valid, you can gain some usefulness out of getting that. But for the most part, there are an awful lot of people who want you to write their story and not your story. And you have to filter all of that out, because, you know, there are going to be people who want a different ending. They want a different outcome for this character. They want different pacing. They want different focus on world elements. Like, you cannot satisfy anyone if you attempt to satisfy everyone. So you really do have to, I can say for me personally, shortly after I was I think it was either my first or second novel, I just blocked Goodreads. I just completely nixed it from all of my devices. So I have not been on Goodreads in years. And this is a decision that I don't really regret. Like, if I absolutely have to, my husband can like get on the computer and like, you know, change my bio if I need to update it and things like that. But I think that I try as much as I can to engage with my audience while also taking absolutely everything that they say with a huge grain of salt and staying true to the original vision. Because I personally tell you that after the first and second Greenbone Saga books, there's fan theories abound, right? Like, you'll see things will come across the transom of, I think this will happen at the end. Oh, I really want this to happen. I want this character to live. I want this character to die. I want, you know, there's, everyone wants something. And so, you know, going in, especially going into a concluding volume, that your choices are not going to be, no matter what you do, your choices are not going to be universally received in a certain way. And you have to focus on telling the story that you want to tell. And so I think that's a constant tightrope walk of how much do you engage and how much do you let that the noise seep into your process. And I try to keep it at bay quite a bit.
Gotcha. Thank you. Well, obviously it's working out very, very well. So congratulations. And Sheree, what do you think?
Everything that Fonda said. Like, the good, the bad, all of it creates this sort of heartbreaking, like, madness. So I just want to say that part completely 100% agree with. And then add this other interesting side. So when I grew up, there was this sort of, there was this dearth of queer women in fantasy. And, you know, been looking for it forever. And now, a few decades later, we've got, like, we're in the gay golden age of fantasy, sci-fi, and fantasy. And so, on the one hand, I see my audience, at least the ones who interact with me, as fellow readers, mostly because I met half of them because we were all yelling about other gay books. Not my gay book, but other books that we all were just like, oh my gosh, look at all these lesbians on the cover with Tommy Arnold. And so in that way, the audience reactions have been really gratifying, and I like letting this aspect of writing in. And it's definitely a tightrope to walk, because you are getting these like, oh, well, these two characters have to get together. And I'm like, do they though? I don't know. I really don't know. And so I might have differing opinions, but there's just so much joy in being able to all be together and all be celebrating the work that we have for us today as readers. And so that's kind of, that's the flip side of where I'm at. And there is a lot of, I have a lot of really great interactions with readers on that score. And while I might not deliver the right pairings, the fact that there are queer pairings at all, like there is a queer older lesbian couple that's already established and, you know, happily ever after or whatever, not, I don't know, they exist, and there's something to be said for that, and people appreciate that. And I think Yeah, that's, I don't know. I think that's it. I can't say it makes up for all of the other stuff, because it just is. It's greater than the other stuff. It's. I don't want to say I hold on to that, because there's a danger in that as well, because then I might be tempted to write toward what they want, which is not always, you know, like I don't want to be tempted to write too much toward, I don't know, making this is a lesbian makeout story. If that's not what I originally intended, I'm not going to say it's not, but like, I don't want to get distracted by, I don't know, by audience desire in that way, but the fact that we are all here to celebrate the same thing, that kind of makes up for some of the reviews that might not get it, so to speak. Because I don't need every review to like agree with how I wrote the book. That's not the point. Or every reader, rather. But for us all just to celebrate the access that we have now is, I don't know, it's nice.
Thank you very much. Yeah, I hear you on all of that. As a quick question, sort of a follow-up to that, do you sometimes feel, because it sounds like you're very much in community with a lot of the readers there, do you sometimes feel as if some of the things that they express in terms of their desires for the way the stories go then do start to make you start to want that for your own story? And, you know, versus maybe where you started out, has some of that happened at all or no? Not really.
It's hard to say, to be honest. And I'm navigating that right now as I try to figure out how this trilogy is going to end. And I feel like probably 75% of my work is trying to put things in like a little bucket. Like, is this a Sheree thing or is this an audience thing? No, this one's an audience. Wait, but maybe it's not. Maybe it is a Sheree thing. And it's kind of hard to say because I'm also changing. It's been like a 3-4 year process. Well, it's been like 15 year process. I don't know how long I've been working on these books, but with the more recent two, like they both were written in a pandemic. And so, and under like extreme political unrest and racial injustice. And so how I'm perceiving what kind of story I want to tell is changing. And so it's hard to see like how much of this is an audience reaction and how much of this is me changing as a person. Because I really enjoy, as many of my readers know, I enjoy really depressing stories. And I'm like, I don't know if I have this in me anymore, at least right now. And so, you know, I probably have to stop talking or I'm gonna like shoot myself in the foot with spoilers. But yeah, so it is hard and something I'm still working on figuring out, honestly.
No, and that's totally fair. Like that makes a lot of sense to me, even in the way that I feel about the whole process as well. Kay, your thoughts on audience reactions, whether they affect the way that you do your work or if you manage to keep it at bay?
So I started out in indie publishing like seven years ago, and you know, books weren't selling. So in the beginning I had that very like, to get reviews, I had to go one-on-one and really interact with reviewers. And there were a few weird reviews that I would consistently get, which is like, it was almost like they would praise the way I wrote. They would say, oh, it's very well written, but I don't understand. And, you know, this was with my first, like my debut novel. And I'm like, I wrote this according to like fantasy convention that I grew up reading. Why are people saying that there's something strange about it? There's something off. And so a lot of my work after that became almost reactionary, where I'm trying to figure out why people would have that response. And, you know, the answer kind of version of, because it's racism. You know, it's, they see me say I'm, you know, I'm Filipino, and then they see the names that my characters have, and they immediately think in their heads that it's non-Western, even though most of them were Western. And it was just like, it was strange, but you know, from then on, I became very, very deliberate with the way I write, because I realized that I couldn't just leave it to chance, because people were misinterpreting it. Even like, I would write one thing and they would have a completely different view of it. And I didn't understand why. Like, is the structure off? Is it, you know, I think there was one person who commented that they couldn't place themselves in my world. And I thought, why is that important? It's fantasy. But, you know, it kind of verged on that question of what kind of Asian are you? You know, it's like, it's fantasy. It's not supposed to have like a, you know, my culture colors the way that I approach things, of course. Like, I think everybody's upbringing changes how they write. But, you know, yeah, so it became very deliberate, and I was still writing in indie at the time. So when I wrote the Wolf of Orinaro, I just didn't care anymore. That was like my fuck F you guys, you know. I just went full blast on it. It's so I wrote that whole trilogy almost like back to back. I think there was only one book in between. I wrote it within a span of a year and a half. And this was long before, like, this was before I got the publishing deal for it. So when I got the book deal, the whole trilogy was already written. So by the time, like, all the early reviewers were coming in, you know, it didn't matter anymore what they were saying. It didn't matter anymore where you're like, oh, I hope this happens, you know. I was just like, yeah, I hope so too. But I already knew, like, I already knew how it was written. I already knew how it ended. So that particular trilogy, I like, it was untouched by reader response in a way. Like, I was responding, but to people who were reacting to my first, like, to my first few books. So it was almost like, you know, I didn't want to write according to convention anymore. I just wanted to write this the way I wanted to write it. Like, it was just very, very deliberate, the way I approached every scene, every, you know, plot point. It was just me, in a way, screaming into a pillow, expressing myself. So, yeah, you know, like Fonda was saying, like, way back in 2017, I completely stopped going to Goodreads as well. It was irritating. Like, I think I couldn't get over how some readers almost expect you to go in their heads and then write a book as they're reading it to respond to how they want it to go. And, you know, when a lot of the things that they're commenting about is cultural, like, I don't have any examples right now, but like, when it feels like it's cultural, it gets in the way of how you write. So since then, I haven't really looked at reviews, and it's been liberating.
As a very quick follow-up, because as you were talking in the beginning about trying to sort of figure out and write in a way that maybe would avoid any sort of these miscommunications or whatever, if you want to call them that, do you feel more free and happy with the work now that you've than when you cast off those kind of concerns?
Yeah, definitely. Like, when you know that they're not going to like your work regardless of what you do, when you know that, you know, it's going to be misread and misinterpreted, and you know, no, like, the only person you can really please is yourself. And I think I've become more imaginative and more like the way I approach plots and character arcs now, I'm really happy with it, like, on a personal level, you know, commercially, I don't know. but on a personal level, I'm happy with it, because, you know, I just, they're not going to read it the way you want them to read it anyway, right? So you might as well just write what you want. Even though at times it feels like what you want is you want them to get it. But yeah, that's the eternal writer's dilemma, I think.
No, I hear you on that, and I think that for me, so much of the focus is in my work is just, am I speaking to the right audience? Like in the sense of like, there is an audience there. There are people who probably read like I do, and will the word find them, right? And so much of that aspect, I guess, is out of our control. And I have to ask the same question to Agne Chavwe about reader expectations and the fact that we can get all this feedback in our lives as we're working. Does it change the way you work? Does it change the work that you do?
Okay. I think this question jumped off of the last one that you asked that I was answering. So, well, I'll first of all say this before I jump in. So, it's a bit clear that I'm not, I do care about reader feedback in terms of making the story better. You know, for example, my novella, my award-winning novella, I sent it to a number of places and it was rejected before I self-published it. So what happened is I took all the personal rejections, all the comments from beta readers, both professionals, you know, I collated them into a list and, you know, I started to tick them off, you know, the ones I would apply, the ones I wouldn't apply. So, you know, and I mean, I have a team of people, writers that, you know, before, you know, after the story, we basically have a session of, okay, hurt me, like kill me, you know, tell me the worst, the most horrible things that you can say about my story in the worst way. So, you know, so I definitely care about feedback, you know, in terms of making the story better. You know, I'm not narcissistic or conceited, but you know what I won't do is, as Fonda said, some people want you to tell their story, and you see, that's not what I'm going to do. For example, we've gotten very funny feedback from, you know, putting out my story, especially when it got nominated for awards. A lot of people had to look at it and you know, the feedback, some of it was really, really funny. You know, for example, someone said the white characters in my story are flat and the black characters are well developed, you know. And this, the only white characters in my story are essentially slavers. They're a group of people who come travel down to enslave and, you know, kidnap. It's sort of like a futuristic, you know, slave trade thing, patrol. So how am I supposed to, or why, even more importantly, am I supposed to humanize people like that? I'm not going to tell that story, and I don't think anybody should, but if anyone should, it definitely shouldn't be me, you know. So I'm not going to write more rounder or more understandable slave traders, you know. So that's not my story, you know. And you know, we kept getting, I've noticed that a lot of my feedback is very similar to Chinonye Gucci's, you know, some of the criticism is exactly the same. It's almost like it's written for the same work, you know, and I kind of understand. I see that, you know, a lot of times, enough for me to notice it, you know, and I realize that sometimes we're not even telling the same kind of stories, you know, but it's almost exactly, you know, and I understand that it's the kind of stories we're telling, you know, when you're telling stories from a limited, or not limited, from a background that has limited exploration or consideration from certain regions like the West, you know, and they find certain points or elements of the story unfamiliar, they tend to believe that instead of it being their own deficiency, they believe that it's the story's deficiency and they put it on you, you know, but it's not on me, you know. You know, they talk about the language, the dialogue, it's not clear enough or it's not funny enough. You know, humor is cultural. You know, it's not my fault that you don't get this. You know, it's always, you know, it has to do with conversations, it has to do with, you know, language, you know. You know, sometimes in, like in Tochi's work, for example, sometimes it's Black American lingo, you know, from certain regions, you know, for my work, it's West African, you know. So, you know, it's about story type. And I'm going to stick to my story. You know, I'm sorry. It's not that I don't care about feedback, you know. There's one other feedback I'm going to mention, you know. Someone said, you know, my story is essentially about sort of like a reverse Black Panther, where, you know, there's a nuclear war, but the Orisha Obatala steps in and basically saves everybody. He makes them evolve, so they develop powers to survive in the environment. And what happens is, the more they reduce, as they reduce, as they die out, they become stronger. You know, each time someone dies, you know, the group becomes, the surviving members sort of, they have an up jump in their powers. You know, it's sort of to ensure their survival. So the smaller they become, the stronger. It's sort of like a compensation. And someone tells me that that's not how, you know, evolution works. That's not, you know, Darwin's theory of evolution. And I'm like, who cares about Darwin? This is Obatala's evolution. I'm not going to tell you that story. That's your story. You can write your sci-fi story, and this is, you know, so. And as much as I care about feedback, I'm not going to change anything. In fact, as a matter of fact, my current work in progress is an expansion of my novella. You know, it's a novel set in the same world, involving the same characters, following some of the same story arcs. It's more of an expansion, you know. So I'm doing everything that I did before, only I'm doing it more, you know, for the people that appreciated it, you know. So if there was grit before, it's going to become more gritty. If there was gore before, it's going to become more gory, you know. So yeah, that's it for me. So I guess you can say the feedback did influence on change my story in some way.
No, thank you very much for that. I think that in one of the, I'm fortunate enough to be in a group of writers and a lot of really talented writers who I incredibly respect. And one of the things that has come out of that group is people saying it's important to lean into who you are. Lean all the way into what you like and who you are, and find your people, right? Find people who are leaning in that same direction, and away you go, right? So it's great to hear that from everybody, that they're kind of doing a lot of that anyway. Let's see here.
Evan, if you don't mind me adding one other thing, I think after listening to everyone talk, I feel like one of the conclusions that, you know, we're all sort of touching on is, you know, not all readers are worth having. You know, like, you, there are plenty of bad readers out there. And by bad, I mean they are bad for you, bad for your work. And you lose those readers. Like, that is fine. You know, you do not need all those readers. You just need the readers that get you and your work. And, you know, you can make a living off of that. And those readers that don't get it, that, you know, leave the reviews that are clearly like, they're not either the cultural nuances are flying right past them, and they don't have a desire to understand them or to lean into that, then, you know, self-select away.
No, very true. And thank you, Fonda. let's see, where am I going to jump to? Oh, here's a question that I think, by the way, it's 2:12 right now on the East Coast. And so we're done in about another 15, 20 minutes. I'm going to open it up for a couple of questions. I guess I can see the questions, I think, from the audience. So I'm going to open it up soon for that. But first, I guess I'll ask maybe one more question, maybe two more, and then we'll see how we go. So this is the question I was looking to ask. Since New York and London publishers appear to have the largest share of the traditionally published English-speaking market, and indeed the majority share of publishing's returns in all languages, to be honest, what do you feel New York and London publishers could do that would be the greatest help for your books in particular? Start with Kay.
I don't spend a lot of time thinking about, you know, how a system that's already in place can, in a way, benefit me. I already assume that it won't. So, you know, a lot of what I do personally is trying to find a way to survive through the cracks. And I don't know. I really don't.
And that's totally fair. It's, none of these questions are easy. And this one's, like you say, there is a system that's been there for literally over a century that works the way it works. And so that's a totally fair answer. And I'm going to ask Sheree, any thoughts on this? And feel free to bow out too if it's not even working for you.
So how can the U.S. London, like New York, London publishing powerhouse help like my books specifically? Is that, I mean, you're trying to get us all in trouble, Evan. So I will say that one thing that has been changing and that I specifically tried to also work toward, and at least as the system is what it is, you know, there has been a push to get the book to the readers who will read benevolently faster. And so when I say that, I say we're going in the whole like pre-buzz phase that TradPub has, that like publicists and marketing folks are trying to get to the reviewers and bloggers who are going to be those better readers faster, instead of sending them to the same like 10 white middle-class American readers who maybe aren't going to understand exactly what different places we might be coming from. Especially if we are critiquing their exact lives, like not everybody is ready to have that. And so that is something good that's happening. Oh man. But I mean, you know, like Kay said, this is a structure that has got a lot of issues with it inherently. And so honestly, like if we were paid better and in a better time structure, my books would be better. and that's a publishing wide thing. Like it's hard for people to write books that they won't be paid for, you know, and so that would be probably it's on the forefront of my mind, but. Don't know why. If I come up with something else, I'll raise my
Thank you. No, and I think those are actually a really important part as well in terms of getting the books to the right readers. I'm a firm believer in that the right reader and the right type of audience for different works. So I think that's a critical component of this is making sure that we stop thinking of readers as sort of a block of people and start finding the right readers for the right works. So yeah, thank you for that. And Ogunechukwu, any thoughts on New York, London? What could they do for your books in particular? What would help your books in particular if they change something about the way they work?
Okay, I would say that they should try to understand the context, you know, of, you know, where the context of literature in relation to place and time, you know, we don't exist in a vacuum. There's a history, there's a way that things have been, you know. So I find that, you know, people tend to ignore the larger context. For example, you know, Nigeria is... you know, it's a lot. It's the poverty capital of the world. You know, there's a very vicious terrorist group, you know, Boko Haram, that's taking over territories. You know, things are difficult. There's a lot of things going on. So if I'm writing from that context, you know, my work might have a certain gritty, dark tone to it. You know, if 10 people are writing from that context, you know, eight of those works might be dark, you know. No, but then you hear a publisher say something like, oh, your works are all dark. They are all gritty. You know, we want something fun and light, you know, and, you know, you're all writing. You know, you're ignoring the context, you know. So I'd like, you know, publishers, I'd like the industry to, like, take cognizance of the context. Of the context surrounding literature, surrounding writers, surrounding the arts, because people don't exist, people don't create in a vacuum. You know, looking at the context of how publishing is in the States, obviously there are more white people, and you know, there's a system of writing that everybody has been inculcated into, that is Western, that is fostered by Hollywood, that is, you know, dominant, you know. There's a paying audience that it's built around, you know. So sometimes, you know, a publisher might have an idea that this book from these cultures are not going to sell, you know, and then they possibly are not going to sell as much as, say, you know, something from J.K. Rowling, you know, and that's not a reflection on the quality. It's a reflection on the context around which the work is built. So instead of seeing that work as a failure or seeing works from these regions, we should try to take in those contexts and work around them and try to shape them. You know, because again, we're not just existing to make profit and get out of here. You know, we're supposed to influence things. We're here for a reason. So if certain types of books are selling and you come and you sell those kind of books and you die and you go next generation of publisher, you know, you haven't done anything. You know, but if you try to influence, you try to change that context, try to leave things a bit more different, not just recognize, but shaping the context, I think that that would be, you know, a very meaningful thing. And allowing for, you know, the correct, the relevant, and you know, the only possible reactions that can come as you, you know, you try to work with, you know, the context of all these things, you know. So that's something that I would like.
No, thank you for that. That was great. Thank you. And Fonda, any thoughts on the question?
Yeah, I think it's a great question, Evan. And I think that one thing that traditional publishing does very well is it has reach, right? Mm-hmm. It has, that is the huge advantage of traditional publishing. What it does not do terribly well is targeting. And it is, you know, I think there are certain almost turnkey publicity and marketing templates for types of books, right? So there, you know, the traditional publishing has kind of a way that it does things. And if you have a classic space opera, you know, there are certain things that traditional publishing will know how to do in order to sell your book to that classic space opera reader. Put a slap a spaceship on the cover, or, you know, slap a dragon on the cover. And, you know, there, those, traditional publishing does that very well. I write books that do not fit into those neat categories. I do not have a spaceship on my cover. I do not have a dragon on my cover. For when the first books came out, there were people did not know what to classify it as. Was it an urban fantasy? Was it an epic fantasy? It's modern era, but it's secondary world. And so that was a challenge for my publisher and for me, right? Was to find that readership. And I think that what I've learned over the years is that the thing that traditional publishing could do to help all authors is to have a greater degree of transparency and a greater degree of partnership with authors to refine and to target, to find the right positioning and the right readership for books. Because that kind of turnkey publicity and marketing template doesn't work for the range of books, and frankly, even the range of books within our own subgenre of fantasy, much less, you know, the range of books that are now able to be successful from an indie published point of view. So having conversations is incredibly valuable. And, you know, what I think that I personally have gotten better at communicating with my publishing team. I feel like earlier on, I was more of a, like, well, they're the publisher. They, like, that's their job, you know, let them, I shouldn't question the cover too much. I shouldn't, you know, ask too many questions. And I've come around from experience to the viewpoint that the partnership is extremely important. and having that dialogue and asking those hard questions and asking for the, you know, the information and what are the plans and, hey, I have this idea. And the more that, and I think publishers, you know, are leery of that oftentimes. They're like, you know, not all authors can handle that, or, you know, we're going to have authors who are divas who just are, we're going to tell us how to do our jobs. But I think that there, it's a win-win to the extent that authors and publishers can just be more communicative with each other, and especially for works that don't fit that traditional mold of, hey, it's going to sell because it has a spaceship on the cover. You know, that conversation needs to happen more quickly, and it has to happen more consistently throughout the process.
Not going to hear me disagree with any of that. So thank you to everyone on the panel. That was an amazing answer to a difficult question. And I'm going to grab a couple of questions from the chat now, if I can see them. We're going to do a quick lightning round. We have about 6 minutes left in the overall panel. The first one, so relatively lightning fast. The Medje of Fayum, hopefully I pronounced that correctly, asks, do you think author salaries will increase in the next 10 years of trad publishing? Let's start with Ogunechovwe. Do you think author salaries will increase in the next 10 years of trad publishing?
I honestly have no idea. I cannot predict how, you know, sometimes you want to be hopeful, you know, because we seem to be progressing, you know, technology, the world, there's a lot more wealth in the world, but you also notice that we're having the same old problems, you know, in different ways, you know, in as much as, you know, wealth is growing, it's also becoming more concentrated in the hands of a few. You know, technology is also expanding, you know, our awareness, our knowledge, you know, wealth, global warming, and, you know, plastic pollution and all these things. But then there's also NFTs and, you know, all these other ways that we undo the progress that we've made. So, I mean, you can always hope, but honestly, with humanity, I don't think you can really predict how things will turn out. So for me, it's just, let's see how it goes.
Totally fair. And Sheree, any thoughts?
I'm with Ogunechobe on that one. Inshallah, but who knows?
Yeah, I kind of feel the same way, I guess. Kay, what do you think? Trad salaries for authors in the next 10 years. What are we looking at?
Have they ever gone up, though? Because going down, like even with inflation? I think it's like with all the salaries, they haven't really been going up. They've all been like sliding down. And
yeah, to be fair, that's even for the publishing workers themselves. So
yeah, exactly. We have a big structural problem here that I think cannot be addressed by in the last 4 minutes.
Going to Fonda then, in the last couple of years of the pandemic, publishing has made more money than it's almost ever made before. Will author income go up over the next 10 years?
I hate to be a pessimist, Evan, but we're seeing just continued consolidation in publishing. We have fewer choices, frankly. On the indie side, I mean, Amazon is the game in town. And, you know, they want to gain market share. And traditional publishers are consolidating in order to meet that behemoth. And so we have fewer and fewer choices as authors. Right? We're now at a point where it's like, if you're in our genre and you have a book out on submission, you've got like a handful of houses that you can go to. And so I think that we will continue to see a lot of pressure on authors, salary pressure. And there will continue to be authors who do very well, who get the big deals, who are paid well. But I'm not hopeful in the aggregate.
Yeah, again, difficult to disagree with the panel on this, so I won't even attempt to do so. We have about 2 minutes. I'm going to do a little closing question, and this actually sort of requires a little bit of audience participation. Before I jump into the question, I want to say thank you to everybody on the panel for doing this. Thank you to our hosts, FanFi Addict and TV Archon. Really appreciate the opportunity and the chance to have this discussion. Here's the final question of the day. There's always a lot of talk about the power or lack of it that online marketing and PR have. Well, if you don't mind, I'd love to test something in the marketing PR type vein, but I need the audience to help me. If you're watching this, right, live or in the future, here's the challenge. Find the nearest online product page for the four books that are about to be mentioned and give the free preview for all four books at least one page of your time. One page. So not a huge ask. If you complete the challenge, come back and comment on the video with challenge complete. Or if you can't do it, comment with I didn't make it. Okay, that's the game. Now, authors on the panel, what one book of yours should they do this with? Fonda.
Oh, gosh. I mean, I have to go with the start of my trilogy, so it would have to be Jade City.
Sounds good. Kay, what one book of yours should they do this with? Ah,
he's just right beside me.
Sheree.
Boom. The Unbroken.
Nailed it. Sounds good. Okay, Travoy, what one book should they do this with?
The Year's Best African Speculative Fiction Anthology.
Excellent. Okay, so that's the challenge. If you're watching this live, in the future, at any point, check out those four books, find the sample online, read at least one page, and come back and comment on whether you were able to complete the challenge or if you didn't make it. I'm just curious, when it come back? Yeah, please, go ahead.
I'm going to just jump in here and say that, Evan, you have been an extremely humble moderator and have not shouted out your own book, so this way. So also go and find Rage of Dragons and add the first page to this challenge. So Evan Winter, author of Rage of Dragons and Fires of Vengeance.
Thank you very much, Fonda. Thank you. And what I plan to do is come back in a few days after this is all done, and I'm going to tally the people who completed the challenge and who didn't as a super microscopic test of just online marketing and PR and how this kind of thing goes. So that was my final question. Thank you to every single one of the panelists. I love the conversation. You gave me so much to think about. This was an absolute honor to speak with you all. Thank you.
Thanks, Evan.
Same here. Thanks.
Thank you, everyone. Yeah.